eyelids were starting to feel heavy. If he weren't careful, he'd be joining Reed soon.
"I'm at Mrs. Swift's home. D.S. Reed and I arrived about 40 minutes ago. Why?"
"Poe, listen to me carefully. I'm going to tell you something, but you can't react. Do you understand?"
Poe said he did.
He noticed his voice was slurred, and his tongue seemed to be thicker than usual. He looked across at Reed, who was now flat out. He was drooling.
"What the hell?"
"Montague Price has just given a full statement. He's denying he's the immolation man," Flynn said.
"Yes, he is,"
Poe said, his thoughts becoming jumbled.
"You're slurring, Poe. Are you drunk?"
Flynn shouted. Poe didn't answer. He had been drunk. He didn't think he was now. Flynn didn't wait for him to gather his thoughts.
"Whatever. I don't have time for this now. Just pay attention. Price has admitted to being on the boat, but it wasn't weekend breaks being auctioned."
"What was it?"
Poe could barely understand what she was saying.
"It was the children, Poe," she replied. "It was the children being sold."
That got through.
"Oh, shit."
He looked across at Swift, who was looking at him strangely.
"And, Poe, Hillary Swift was on the boat."
"Shit, shit, shit."
"She and Carmichael organized the whole thing."
Poe tried to focus on the woman opposite. His vision was blurring, and he realized it was nothing to do with a hangover or late-night fatigue. This was something different.
"We don't have anyone near. You and D.S. Reed are going to have to detain her. Can you do that, Poe?"
Poe recognized the early stages of sedation. He tried to fight it, but had no chance. He was about to succumb to whatever he'd been given.
"Steph," he slurred. "She's fucking drugged us."
He tried to stand, but fell back onto the sofa. He dropped the phone. He was vaguely aware of Flynn shouting through the BlackBerry's microphone.
"Poe! Poe! Are you all right?"
Eventually the voice faded, and his eyes rolled back. 10 seconds later, everything disappeared. Chapter 42. Poe came round in installments. He tried consciousness a few times before it fully took. He had no idea how long he'd been out. It could have been days. It could have been minutes. He opened his eyes and tried to focus on the people milling around him.
"Jesus! What happened?"
he heard Reed say.
"I've a mouth like a camel's scrotum."
Poe's throat was parched as well. His head was thumping. He tried putting the pieces together. After a while, fragments of memory began to take shape, and his brain could form thoughts. Hillary Swift had drugged them both, and judging by the hideous pink color scheme, they were still in her house. If that were the case, then they couldn't have been out for long. There were over 20 people in her front room, and some were wearing the green of paramedics. He looked down when he felt something tightening on his arm. His blood pressure was being taken. Some idiot tried to stick something in his ear, and he jerked away.
"Poe, stop being a dick and let her take your temperature."
It was Flynn.
"Steph."
His voice was little more than a croak.
"You and D.S. Reed have been drugged."
Poe scowled.
"That much I've worked out."
Another thought formed.
"Where's Swift?"
"She's gone, Poe. DCS Gamble's team are searching the house now, but it looks like she left in a hurry. Must have been picked up, as her car's still outside."
"What about the grandchildren?"
"What grandchildren?"
"There were kids in the house."
"Are you sure?"
she asked urgently.
"I heard them."
Flynn called across to Reed.
"D.S. Reed, D.S. Poe says there were children here."
"Two, I think,"
Reed confirmed. She shouted for Gamble, and he hurried over, an annoyed look on his face.
"D.S. Reed and D.S. Poe both say there were children here when they arrived, sir. I think she's running with them."
"That's all I fucking need," Gamble growled.
He turned to one of the detectives with him.
"Get on to the border agency now. Tell them she could be traveling with children."
He turned to Reed.
"Age? Sex? Description? Anything that can help?"
"Didn't see them, boss,"
Reed said.
"They were upstairs.
I think she said they were called Annabel and Jeffrey.
Jeremy, Poe corrected.
Annabel and Jeremy, Reed confirmed. The one who called Swift Grandma sounded young.
Bollocks, Gamble shouted. Poe understood his anger. If the UKBA had been told to look out for a woman on her own, they wouldn't have been paying as much attention to anyone with children. And if Swift made it through a border, Poe doubted they'd ever see her again.
I'll get on to Swift's daughter and get some photos emailed over, boss, Reed said.
It looked as though Gamble was about to argue, to tell Reed he wasn't doing anything. Instead, he said,
At least you can explain your own fuck-up. Tell her how her children were abducted from underneath your nose.
Reed reddened and nodded. It was unfair, and Poe wasn't sure of the significance of Swift's rapid disappearance, but the fact she had drugs to hand surely meant she was involved. He'd already heard one of Gamble's detectives voice the opinion that they were now looking for the immolation woman. A consensus was forming. It fitted the facts as they knew them. It answered all Gamble's questions. That was all well and good, he thought, but it didn't answer all his questions. The big one was still unanswered. Why? He didn't care what the others were thinking. He had the same problem with Swift being the killer as he did with Price. Why wait all these years? Of course, with all the evidence pointing her way, it was probable Swift was their killer, and that she had a lucid explanation why she'd waited all this time to kill her partners in crime. But Poe didn't want to die wondering. He wouldn't be able to sleep until he'd understood her motive, or how he was involved. To coin one of Bradshaw's favourite phrases, he needed more data, and there was only one place to start. Montague Price's confession. He tried to stand up, but his legs were rubbery. They collapsed under him.
Whoa, said the paramedic. You're going nowhere till a doctor's checked you out. We need to put some saline into you.
And you can consider that an order, D.S. Poe, Flynn said from across the room.
For once, he had no intention of disobeying. Chapter 43. The incident room was jammed. Every moulded plastic seat had a hairy-arsed cop wedged into it. The high ceiling had flickering lights and off-white drop-in panels. Some were newer than the rest and were an annoyingly different colour. Like every police incident room, it smelled of fried food, coffee, and frustration. Poe found it comforting. He stood at the back and listened to Gamble update the massed ranks of the team searching for Hillary Swift. It was 2 days after she drugged Poe and Reed and made her escape. It was Poe's first day back on the job. So far, there hadn't been a hint of a sighting. She'd either successfully fled the country or hadn't yet tried. As well as the search for Swift, Gamble was trying to locate the boys that Price claimed had been sold on the night of the auction. His theory being that if the train tickets had been a ruse to make the police think they'd fled to London, then they had to be somewhere else. Gamble was convinced that if they found just one of them, the rest of the puzzle would slot neatly into place. He had teams of detectives assigned to it. Poe wished them luck, but he wasn't convinced. One of the unintended consequences of Operation U-Tree, the high-profile national investigation into historic sexual offences against children, was that the reporting of abuse was now at a record level. More and more victims were coming out of the shadows. Their allegations were being taken seriously. But for 26 years, these boys had said nothing, even with all the press the immolation man's victims had been getting recently. One of them would have come forward, even if it were just to ask how much compensation they might be entitled to. In Poe's opinion, the explanation for the boys' continued silence was simpler. And far darker. They were dead. It was a thought he kept to himself. During Poe's overnight stay in hospital, Bradshaw had kept him up to date with what had happened in his absence. Swift had used a drug called propofol to put him and Reed to sleep. The tests on the evidence found at Montague Price's home had been completed. Propofol was the unknown liquid in the vial. It was one of the most commonly used anesthetics. It was fast-acting, could be taken orally, and didn't stay in the body long. It was a heavily controlled substance, and Gamble had assigned 4 detectives to try and locate her source. They might not yet know where she got the propofol from, but its use did provide an answer to one of the unanswered questions. How had five men been abducted without any sign of a struggle? They'd almost certainly been drugged and taken when they were semi-conscious. Gamble's working theory now was that they were either in on it together, or Swift had been trying to set up Price. With the how answered, the why could wait, apparently. All the victims had empty stomachs, which gave additional credence to the theory that propofol had been used to facilitate their abduction. To keep her method unknown, Gamble believed Swift had kept her victims captive until the propofol was out of their systems, at least 2 days, according to the medical advice they'd been given. The search was on for her makeshift containment facility. As Gamble prattled on, Poe caught Bradshaw's eye and gestured for her to join him at the back of the room.
"What do you reckon the two of us get out of here?" he said. "Go back to Shapwell's and do some police work."
"Thought you'd never ask, Poe."
Poe knew Flynn had been in on Montague Price's interview, and that she'd already emailed Bradshaw a copy of the video.
"Do you think Hilary Swift is the immolation woman, Poe? I'd be ever so surprised if she was."
"Why do you say that, Tilly?"
"Statistics. 85% of serial killers are male."
"Still leaves 15%, Poe replied.
"And less than 2% of females have used fire to kill."
"Go on, then."
"Go on, then, what?"
"I know you've done the maths. What are the chances of a female serial killer who also uses fire?"
"Statistically improbable, Poe."
He sighed. An absence of motive, and now he had Bradshaw's maths. He didn't care what Gamble thought. Poe's gut was telling him that although Swift was involved, she wasn't their killer. "Come on. Let's go and see Price's confession." The video was as clear as a 4K television. The interview room Gamble had used was small and square. Every line was straight, and every corner sharp. The walls were cream and bare. The only things in the room were chairs, a table, and some recording equipment. It was a serious room, with a serious purpose. Montague Price was a thin man in his 70s. Poe could see liver spots on his hands. He was resplendent in a tweed suit, complete with waistcoat and tie-pin, every inch the country gent everyone believed him to be. He'd been a big man in the hunting and shooting fraternity. He'd represented Great Britain in clay pigeon shooting. That made him virtual royalty in Cumbria. He was visibly shaking. Poe suspected the underlying reason was medical rather than a fear of what was coming. Bartholomew Ward, his solicitor, had travelled up from London and was rumoured to be costing Price £3,000 a day. Gamble, as chief superintendent, was too high in rank to sit in on interviews, but Price and his solicitor had agreed beforehand to waiver this in the spirit of cooperation. Flynn was in the room representing the NCA, and a detective Poe didn't know was also present. When the introductions had been made, and the recording equipment had been double-checked, Bartholomew Ward kicked it off.
"Gentlemen," he said, with no deference to the fact Flynn was in the room, "I'm about to give you a prepared statement by my client. I would like it formally acknowledged that my client has surrendered himself to your custody voluntarily."
Gamble snorted.
His face was all over the news.
"Nevertheless."
"Noted," said Gamble.
"And agreed?"
asked Ward. Gamble paused.
"Agreed. Your client attended Durren Hill voluntarily."
Without taking her eyes off the screen, Bradshaw asked Poe,
"Durren Hill?"
"Carlisle's newest police station. They moved there a few years after the 2005 floods wrecked the old one. Cost £8 million, and it looks like the back of a football stand." They turned to the interview.
"And I'd also like it acknowledged that my client has not been charged with anything."
"Agreed. Your client has not been charged with anything. Yet."
With those two small victories in the bag, Ward said,
"My client is deeply ashamed of his small part in the terrible events of that night 26 years ago. He acknowledges he should have approached the authorities sooner than he did, but you'll note that at no point was he involved in the planning or the execution of what happened."
With his mitigation out of the way, Ward handed Gamble a document. For the next 5 minutes, no one spoke. Every now and then, Gamble would look up in disbelief. Price and Ward remained expressionless. Gamble put down the document and said,
I think it would be helpful if I summarized for the benefit of the video and my two colleagues.
Ward nodded.
Your client was one of six men invited to a charity auction on Ullswater. He knew something illegal was going to happen as the invitation was coded.
Gamble looked up, and although he already knew, he asked,
Coded how?
Price spoke for the first time, and his voice was as croaky as Poe's had been 2 days earlier.
The invitation had an archaic punctuation mark in the title. It's called a percontation point, and it means...
I know what it means. It means there's an underlying message in the preceding sentence.
Price and Ward looked at each other. Ward said,
May I ask how you have knowledge of this? It is unused today.
No, you may not,
Gamble said. He continued.
Your client believed that the cruise was a cover for an adult party. High-class call girls and unlimited cocaine. Have I understood that correctly?
You have, Ward replied.
And for this, he was willing to pay, up front I may add, £25,000?
He was, and he did.
25 grand for some hookers and coke. Bit steep, wasn't it? My client was not familiar with the going rate for such things. Naivety is not a crime.
Gamble did an admirable job of keeping calm.
Just watching the interview through the medium of a small laptop screen was making Poe's teeth itch. The whole point of Price's statement was to limit his exposure to the bad stuff. He would admit what could be proved and deny what couldn't.
And once he got on board, he realized it wasn't cocaine and prostitutes, but children that were for sale?
That is correct.
The four boys Hilary Swift had brought with her to act as waiters.
Price tried to suppress a smile. Poe could tell that even after all this time, he was still getting off on it.
There were six of us, but only three boys were available. Carmichael kept one for himself. He wanted us bidding against each other to drive up the price, he explained.
Ward put his hand on his shoulder.
I do the talking. The boys, just like my client, were unaware they were the star attractions, and by the time Mr. Price realized what was happening, the boat had long left the shore. He had no choice but to go along with it.
Why?
He feared for his life, Ward said.
A fear you'll agree was rational, given the circumstances we now find ourselves in.
Gamble didn't take the bait. He kept going, summarizing the statement.
The boys were plied with alcohol before the auction began, and one by one, Hilary Swift paraded them for everyone. When they'd all been up and down a few times, and the men had had a chance to inspect the goods, the bidding be-
Hang on, Flynn interjected. Are you saying Hilary Swift was on the boat?
Most certainly she was. She and Carmichael organized it all, said Ward. Is that a problem?
Gamble and Flynn leaned in and whispered together. Flynn left the room. Presumably, that had been when she'd called Poe and asked him to arrest Hilary Swift. Flynn being out of the interview room didn't stop Ward.
Obviously, my client was appalled by what was happening and took no further part in the proceedings.
Obviously, Gamble deadpanned. And after the bidding, the boat came back to shore, and the men disappeared with what they'd bought?
Ward shook his head.
No. First, Quentin Carmichael produced a video he'd taken of the whole thing, and explained it was everyone's insurance.
And then?
And then nothing. My client never saw any of the men again. He cut off all contact with them.
And his understanding about the fate of the boys?
He doesn't know. He would like it placed on record that he hopes no harm came to them.
The DC in the room, quiet up until then, burst out of his chair and shouted,
Lying fucking bastard!
He tried to punch Price, but Gamble bear-hugged him and shouted for assistance. A pair of uniformed officers rushed in and dragged the struggling detective out. Ward spread his arms, as if a point had been made.
This is why he hasn't come forward until now.
Wait until he gets to prison, Gamble murmured. They're gonna fucking love him there.
Ah, said Ward. I think we might have a problem then. Because if you want my client to testify against the real culprits, Hilary Swift and Quentin Carmichael, then he's going to need assurances that he will not be charged with anything more than assisting an offender.
Fuck you, said Gamble. No way is he walking away from this. I already knew most of what's in this statement. Oh, and by the way, Quentin Carmichael has been dead for about a quarter of a century, so half your bargaining chips are already gone.
This was news to them. They began whispering urgently. Price started gesticulating at Ward. For the first time, he looked worried. At that point, the door opened and Flynn rushed in. She bent down and spoke into Gamble's ear.
Interview suspended, Gamble said.
Ward and Price both looked at him.
You're shit out of luck. Hilary Swift's disappeared. Looks like the music stopped, and you don't have a chair, Mr. Price.
Chapter 44 Flynn found them in the garden room at Shap Wells. Reed was more useful to Gamble now and had been reassigned to the main investigation.
Gruesome, isn't it? Flynn asked.
To put it mildly, Poe replied. Where is Price now?
Still in a cell in Carlisle Nick. Gamble's meeting the CPS soon to see what they can charge him with.
A holding charge?
Enough to get him remanded, certainly. The full charges will follow when the investigation ends.
The evidence found in his home?
Looks like Swift was setting him up. The evidence might be real, but he has a cast-iron alibi for the last two murders. He can prove he was hiding out in London. Gamble thinks, and I agree, that Swift was trying to buy some time. Probably wasn't banking on Price handing himself in so soon.
Poe ignored the assumption of Swift's guilt. She was involved, but that didn't mean she was the all and everything.
If Price was in hiding, by leaving evidence at his home, the real immolation man could have been trying to flush him out.
Flynn frowned.
You think he's a potential victim?
Why not? He replied. Everyone else on that boat seems to have been. What makes him so different? And if whoever's doing this had managed to abduct him and quietly make him disappear, would any of us have looked any further than him?
Probably not, she admitted. And you said immolation man instead of Swift. I take it you're not yet convinced of her guilt.
She's definitely working with the immolation man. Her use of propofol can't be ignored. It might even have been her who left all the evidence at Price's. Whether or not she's been burning people is a different matter entirely. Tilly has some sums you probably need to see.
I'll have a look later. What else do you have?
Well, up until now, the only motive we've been able to come up with had been financial, Poe said. And that never made sense. Not really.
Castrations and burnings over money?
I don't think so.
Then what?
I don't know yet, he said. He did, but he didn't want to voice it out loud. Not in front of Bradshaw.
Flynn steepled her fingers and closed her eyes. She opened them after a minute and leaned forwards.
Okay, then. Let's do what we're paid to do.
Gamble can chase Swift. We're the serious crime analysis section, and that means we do the things others can't. Bradshaw nodded. Eventually, Poe did, too. Poe said,
We start with the transport. We have 5 abductions and 5 murders, and because there was no trace of propofol in any of the victims, we now know for sure the victims had to have been kept somewhere before they were killed. That's additional journeys we didn't know about.
So, the killer had to drive to the abduction site, from the abduction site to the containment site, then from the containment site to the murder site,
Bradshaw summarized.
That's a lot of data, Poe.
I thought you liked data.
She smiled and said,
I love data.
She punched some keys, and before long the printer was whirring.
The more I have, the more I can do. I'll open up our link to the automatic number plate recognition database and get cracking.
Poe led Flynn away from Bradshaw, and making sure she was out of earshot, told her what he hadn't wanted to say earlier.
I think we need to assume those boys are dead. Flynn nodded. Her face was grim.
That much I'd worked out. You have a theory?
I do. I think 25 grand bought you the right to abuse them.
And the three who paid the six-figure amounts?
For that amount of money, I think you got to kill them.
That's what I think too, Flynn said, after a long moment.
Neither of them had noticed the printer had stopped. Bradshaw had heard them.
Oh, no!
She gasped. Tears flooded her eyes, and before long she was crying. Flynn sat next to her and put her arms around her shoulders. For over a year, Bradshaw had worked on some of the worst cases in the country, but up until then, it had always been Long Arm. Even when she'd studied the carving of his name in Michael James's chest, it had been computer images rather than an actual body she'd been looking at. Here, out in the field, she had as much invested as he did. More, perhaps. She was nice. Poe wasn't. It was more than half an hour before Bradshaw was composed enough to resume work. Poe felt guilty. If he hadn't insisted she accompanied them up to Cumbria, and he knew he'd only been making a point at the time, she could have been spared all this. Flynn said quietly,
"You and Tilly seem to be getting on okay. Despite what's just happened, getting her out of the office has done her the world of good."
Poe looked at his new friend. She'd pushed her glasses up, and her tongue was sticking out in determination. Tear tracks were still on her face. A wisp of hair flapped about in the air conditioning. She stuck out her bottom lip and blew it away from her eyes. A feeling of protective warmth spread over Poe. There were only a few years between them, but in terms of life experiences, there were decades. Her naivety and innocence contrasted sharply with his own dark nature, but in many ways they were alike. They were both obsessives, and they both rubbed people up the wrong way. Thinking about Bradshaw reminded him about something. She'd been the one who'd interpreted the data from the MSCT that uncovered his name in Michael James's chest, and his own connection to the case was still unclear. Hilary Swift was involved somehow, but Poe was certain she hadn't recognized him or his name. If she were the immolation man's accomplice, then she hadn't been read into the wider plan. Gamble still had a detective going through Poe's background in the slim hope of her name cropping up. So far, there'd been nothing. And Poe doubted the answer was in his past. Up until the Peyton Williams case, he'd been fairly uncontroversial. He'd put some nasty men behind bars, but none of them had been released in the last 12 months. But Poe's name had been carved into the chest of the third victim. That was an indisputable fact, which meant they were still missing something. Poe looked across at Bradshaw. The printer was spitting out documents, but she'd begun to pin some of the early ones to the wall. Automatic Number Plate Recognition, or ANPR, was the largest database of its type in the world. There would be a lot of data to get through.
"How long do you think you'll be before you finish sorting through all this chaos, Tilly?" Poe asked, sweeping his arms around to indicate the various piles of documents.
Bradshaw stopped what she was doing. Poe could almost hear the mental calculations in her head. She didn't do guesstimates.
4 hours, 30 minutes, Poe, she said. I think I can have something for us to review by then.
Poe turned to Flynn.
I think we need to consider a different motive, boss.
I'm listening, she said.
We suspect that the men who deposited the six-figure amounts were paying to kill their victims, yes?
Flynn nodded.
And if that's the case, then before they died, the boys suffered appallingly.
She nodded again.
Well, what if someone found out? Poe asked. And they're seeking some sort of natural justice.
It would fit the ferocity of the killings.
Could one of the boys have survived? Flynn asked.
Poe shook his head.
If one of them had, the six men would have been far warier than they had been. No, whoever's doing this was unknown to them. Plus, why wait 26 years?
Who, then? We've identified everyone now.
Have we? Poe replied.
I know they were in care, but those boys had to have had families at some point.
What if someone's latent parental responsibility has woken? She didn't look convinced.
Look, we have 5 hours to kill. We might as well do something.
What do you have in mind? I think we need to go back to the beginning.
How Carmichael ended up in a salt store?
Surely that's irrelevant now.
No, earlier than that, he said. The Seven Pines warrant was made out to us, not Cumbria Police, and it's still valid. I say we go back to Children's Services and look at the lives of those boys. I want to know why they were at Seven Pines in the first place.
Chapter 45.
What do you need?
Audrey Jackson asked. Flynn and Poe were back at Carlisle Civic Centre. After he'd convinced Flynn that they should take advantage of their warrant, she'd been decisive. It seemed she'd grown tired of being Gamble's assistant.
Background on the boys, Flynn replied.
And their families, Poe added. Plus the staff and the rest of the kids who were in Seven Pines at the same time as they were.
That's going to be a big list. Part of the home's role was short-term assessments. Some beds had a pretty high turnover.
Neither of them responded. Flynn folded her arms.
I'll see what I can dig up, Jackson said.
She returned with files on the boys. Ho suspected she'd recently been looking at them. She placed them on the table. They were pitifully thin. There were four of them, one for each boy. Four kids who'd been dealt a shit hand. Looked after by the state because their parents couldn't, wouldn't, or shouldn't. Seven Pines should have been their sanctuary, a place for them to mend, to learn how to love and to be loved, a place for them to trust adults again. Instead, they were sold for the sport of rich, bored men. Poe's resolve hardened. He didn't care if he had to look at paperwork for the next 10 years. If the answer was in these files, he'd find it. He opened them all and laid out the basic information side by side. Michael Hilton, Matthew Malone, Andrew Smith, Scott Johnston. Four lives snuffed out. He took a sip from the coffee Jackson had brought for them and began reading. Flynn started on the other children. An hour later, and his despair had deepened. Each file was horribly different and depressingly similar. Michael Hilton, neglected so much that at the age of 9, he weighed less than the average 5-year-old. When the social workers finally managed to remove him from the family home, he'd been eating flies to stay alive. The parents each got a year in custody. Poe hoped they'd been force-fed insects in prison. Michael had been passed around the system, but behavioural problems rooted in the appalling start he had to life meant he couldn't settle. Seven Pines was his last chance, and he appeared to have grabbed it with both hands. Andrew Smith, a star pupil at school until his grades began slipping. When he was asked to stay behind one night to discuss why, he'd freaked out. He told his teacher he had to go to work. Mystified, they'd called the police, who found heroin in his satchel. His father had been using him as a drug mule. Both his parents fled to Spain, where they still lived, apparently. They sent Children's Services a birthday card for him every year, along with some money. With no forwarding address for Andrew, the last few were still in the file. Scott Johnston probably had the most common reason for being removed from the family home. His mother was a domestic abuse victim who refused to leave her partner. Poe wasn't surprised. It happened more than people realized. Regardless of the consequences, some women found it impossible to leave their abusers. When Children's Services said that the home wasn't safe for young Scott, and that she had to make a choice, her partner or her child, she chose her partner. The social worker had tried to locate his natural father without success. Scott entered the system and never left it. Poe made a note about his father. He'd get Reed to chase it up later. So far, he was the only person who'd had even a hint of motive. And finally, Matthew Malone. Perhaps the saddest case of all, because he'd come from a happy, well-adjusted family in Brighton. His mother had died when he was young, and proving just how fragile family units could be, his father had hooked up with a heroin addict from Zaire. Within a month, they'd fled her drug debts in Brighton and moved up to Cumbria. A month after that, the woman was accusing Matthew of being a sorcerer. His father, who by then had an £80-a-day habit of his own, had either been oblivious to it or happy to let it happen. The woman was obsessed with the idea of ridding the boy of his demons, and believed the best way to do that was by driving them out with pain. Matthew was tied to a hardback chair while she stubbed out cigarettes on his arms and torso. Matthew, to his credit, wasn't having any of that. As soon as he could get away, he fled to Workington Police Station. His father was imprisoned for 4 years for allowing it to happen. He served, too, and according to the file, overdosed on the day of release. An all-too-familiar tale of addicts underestimating the strength of street heroin compared to prison heroin. The woman got 9 years for grievous bodily harm with intent, but died during her first year in prison, the result of the same type of shit. This time, though, instead of an 8-year-old boy, it was her cellmate, a 15-stone Glaswegian headcase whom she'd accused of being a witch. The Scot, a lifer who'd murdered her husband, smashed her accuser's head onto the rim of the cell toilet until her skull had the consistency of an overripe banana. Poe grunted in satisfaction. He reviewed the notes various social workers, family judges, and guardians ad litem had made throughout the years. The boys had never stood a chance. Apart from Scot Johnston's father, there was little evidence that any of the boys' families would be out there somewhere seeking their revenge. They were either dead, in prison, or didn't give a shit. There was one photograph of the four boys together. It looked as though it had been taken with an instant camera. It had that thick white band at the bottom, the part you held as you waved it in the air, waiting for it to dry. The photograph was poor quality, and had presumably been taken during a Seven Pines outing to a beach somewhere. The boys were smiling in the sunshine. It was tops-off weather. Smith was holding a football. They looked happy. Despite the quality of the old photograph, Poe could see the cigarette scars on Malone's arms and chest. He put it down, carefully. His eyes were moist, and he wiped them before tears could form. "Why weren't any of them fostered out?" he asked. "I know Hilton had behavioural problems, but the other three seemed to be thriving at Seven Pines. Was it because they didn't want to be separated?" Jackson shook her head.
"Apart from Michael, who, as you said, had some deep-rooted psychological issues he still hadn't worked through, they all came to us later in life, and at that time it was virtually impossible to get young boys placed. They ended up friends because they weren't being fostered," she explained. "It became a badge of honour with them, a nobody likes us and we don't care kind of thing."
It was a depressing answer, and Poe went back to the files. When he'd finished skimming them, he put them down. He needed some fresh air before he tackled a deeper study. Flynn, who was reading similar horror stories with different children, followed him. Jackson joined them a few moments later. She sparked up a cigarette and drew the poison deep into her lungs.
"How do you put up with this shit, day in, day out?" Poe asked. She shrugged. "If I don't, who will?"
It was an answer, of sorts. It didn't invite further conversation. Jackson lit another cigarette from the one she'd been smoking. After 5 minutes, they went back inside. Poe reopened the files, determined to find something. Flynn's phone rang. She showed Poe the caller ID. It was Gamble.
"Sir?"
Her expression darkened as she listened.
"Shit,"
she muttered finally.
"And there's no doubt?"
She frowned some more before hanging up. Poe raised his eyebrows.
"Hilary Swift's daughter has just landed. She's confirmed that her mother was in Australia when Clement Owens was killed at Cockermouth."
Poe felt his pulse quicken. "So we are looking for someone else." Chapter 46 Gamble called an emergency meeting for later that day, and as the files on the children from Seven Pines hadn't revealed anything actionable, they'd returned to Shap Wells. Jackson had copied everything for them, and Poe vowed to take them home and read it all again later. Sometimes his brain needed a calmer environment. Bradshaw hadn't been slacking while they'd been away. She was surrounded by reams of paper. She'd needed the hotel's strong Wi-Fi, so the garden room, despite its drawbacks, had become their makeshift incident room again. It was as cluttered as the inside of Poe's mind. Bradshaw looked up anxiously.
"D.I. Stephanie Flynn, I think I've spent all our money on colour printing." "Don't worry about it, Tilly. I'm the budget holder."
She stared at the masses of paperwork.
Exactly how many sheets have you printed?" 804, she replied.
Flynn looked worried.
Bradshaw dug her grave a little deeper.
The hotel had to send out for more ink. Twice.
It's cheap if we find something, boss, Poe said. Now we know there's another player. AMPR might just be our best shot.
Unlike Cumbria Constabulary, the National Crime Agency had live access to the automatic number plate recognition database. ANPR is the law enforcement system that reads, checks, and records every vehicle that passes one of the 8,000 fixed and mobile cameras in the UK. With over 45 million cars in the country, ANPR cameras take close to 26 million photographs a day. And because the National ANPR Data Centre, or NADC, holds every image for 2 years, at any one time there are over 17 billion photographs in its archives. Poe knew that Gamble had requested mobile ANPR cameras on the likely routes to some of the more prominent stone circles, but had bossed out.
"What have you got for us, Tilly?" Poe asked.
Bradshaw, still not sure if she was in trouble or not, coughed nervously and said,
"After I downloaded the data from the ANPR cameras I wanted, I ran it through a program I'd been working on for a couple of months in my spare time. The way I see it, this is a chaotic system problem, so I adapted the Kuramoto model to assess the synchronization order."
She looked at them as if she'd just said something they had any chance of understanding.
"Dumb it down a bit, Tilly," Poe said, not unkindly.
"Oh, right. Basically, Poe, under the right conditions, chaos spontaneously evolves into a lockstep system."
Flynn and Poe continued to stare at her blankly.
"I've redefined the parameters," she sighed.
Neither of them responded.
"You have to be kidding me," Bradshaw said, shaking her head. "Jeez, do you two still point at planes?"
"Eh?"
Poe said.
"I ran a program, and I've got you a list of car registration numbers."
"Ah, a list. Why didn't you say so?"
Bradshaw stuck her tongue out at him before pulling a pile towards her.
"I focused on the journeys the immolation man would have had to make. Abduction to containment site to crime scene."
Poe nodded. This he could follow.
"We know when and where four of the victims were killed, and I correlated that with the cameras nearest their homes."
It made sense. She was trying to find vehicles that had passed the cameras nearest to the killing sites, and had also passed cameras near the likely abduction sites.
"We have five victims," Flynn reminded her. "We do, D.I. Stephanie Flynn, but for analytical purposes, the man in Quentin Carmichael's coffin is an outlier. We don't know when he was put in the coffin, and we don't know where or when he was killed."
She paused to let them catch up. Poe noticed that when she was talking about data, she lost her awkwardness.
"Of course, we're not in London, so ANPR cameras only cover the M6, the A roads, and some of the bigger B roads. But I calculated that in all the abductions, some of these cameras would have to be crossed at least once, the ones on the M6 and the ones that cover the roads that cross the M6.
Poe agreed. A bit like a major river, the M6 corridor bisected the county through the middle. It was inconceivable that the immolation man hadn't had to cross the motorway at least once. In all probability, he'd passed over it, under it, and driven along it several times. Bradshaw continued.
"But the ANPR list was far too big. It was six figures high."
"People use their cars more in rural counties," Poe explained. "ANPR covers all the commuter routes, so I'm surprised the number wasn't bigger."
"After I'd run the numbers through my program, it became a bit more manageable. I split the list into three. The first list is the vehicles with the highest probability, 804 in total," she said. "That's the list I coloured in."
As well as logging all necessary details, like a vehicle's registration, where and when it was snapped, that type of thing, ANPR cameras also take two photographs, one of the registration plate and one of the whole vehicle. When Bradshaw said she'd had some of the ANPR data coloured in, she meant she downloaded those photographs, and probably to appease her analogue colleagues, she then printed them off. The cost didn't matter, though. Bradshaw had two PhDs. She was a member of the Mathematics Institute at Oxford University, and she had an IQ higher than anyone Poe had ever heard of. If she said the killer was in that pile of paper somewhere, then he believed her. He settled down to read. Flynn did the same. Bradshaw smiled. ANPR was a fantastic investigative tool when you knew what you were looking for, but its big weakness was that when you were casting a net, it was virtually worthless. It caught everyone, and Poe knew this was why Gamble hadn't really bothered before. He was sure that at some point he'd have tasked detectives with reviewing ANPR, but it would have been to tick boxes rather than a genuine investigative strategy. He'd have no way of reducing that list from the same six figures Bradshaw found. But Gamble's detectives weren't mathematical geniuses. Bradshaw was. It was still an immense amount of data to review, but Poe didn't lose focus. His faith in Bradshaw was absolute. The answer was there, somewhere. After he'd read a page, Bradshaw would take it from him and pin it to the wall in a pattern known only to her. It was a good idea. Looking at the montage gave a different perspective to looking at them individually. Of course, at some point, they'd have to deal with the hotel manager's wrath when he saw what they'd done to his freshly decorated wall, but that was a problem for another day. Or for Flynn. During a break to stretch his legs, Poe walked across to the flipboard the hotel had supplied and they had never used. Bradshaw frowned upon such technologically backwards tools and picked up a marker pen from the tray underneath. He walked to the wall and started putting red crosses through vehicles he felt confident in ruling out. Out of the 804 vehicles, over 30 were buses full of passengers. He put a red cross through them, doubting the immolation man had brought a coachload of supporters to his bonfires. He ruled out all the motorcycles. They might be able to go anywhere, but they couldn't be used to transport victims, containers of accelerant and stakes. There were four minibuses, and although the pictures were small, Poe could see they were charities transporting adults with learning difficulties. He red-crossed them. There were others he was happy to cross out as well. Police vehicles were an obvious one. It was possible the immolation man was a cop, but police vehicles weren't used by one person. They did 8 or 10 hours with one shift, then would immediately be on the road with the next one. He crossed off ambulances for the same reason. Next up were the prisoner escort vans. The county's tagline for years had been, Cumbria, a safe place to live, work, and visit. And the immolation man aside, it usually was. But there was still a hardcore element of crooks and ne'er-do-wells, and although the number of courts had reduced, the number of idiots hadn't. The GU security vans were a regular sight on the Cumbrian roads, as they serviced the county's courts and its sole prison. But they were also shift vehicles. Poe put a red cross through them all. He also red-crossed the bigger lorries. Although they'd have been ideal for transporting bodies and equipment, the winding routes to some of the killing sites ruled them out. The number of pictures without red crosses was still unmanageable, though. Poe stood up and down on his tiptoes to stretch his calf muscles while he thought how he could reduce the number further. He walked back to the wall and, in a fit of pique, red-crossed every car he thought was too small to comfortably transport a driver, a body, and a can of petrol. When he'd finished, he threw down the pen in frustration. "Sorry," he apologized, more for Bradshaw's sake than Flynn's.
"You okay?" Flynn asked.
He nodded.
"Well, keep going. I think you're onto something."
He walked back to the flip chart and picked up a green pen. He ticked vehicles he wanted to prioritize. Any van with panelled sides got a green tick. Any estate car, 4x4 or MPV got a tick. There was even a hearse. That got a double tick. Eventually, every vehicle either had a red cross or a green tick. Some, after discussion, changed colour, but after an hour, they had some sort of consensus. Poe rocked backwards and forwards on his heels as he scrutinised the wall. He was sure the answer was there. He just needed a spark of inspiration to find it.
Chapter 47. They stared at the wall well into the evening. As they didn't want to take down the pinned ANPR pictures, and because none of them fancied eating in shifts, Poe drove into Kendal to get food from the British Raj Indian and Tandoori takeaway. He just ordered butter chicken for Flynn, vegetable balti for Bradshaw, and lamb madras for himself, when his phone alerted him to an incoming text. It was from Reed, saying he'd been to Herdwick Croft. He wanted to know where he was. Ho typed a reply, telling him they were at the hotel and that he should walk across to meet them. He ordered him a lamb madras. The hotel was kind enough to provide plates and cutlery, and they'd begun eating when Reed arrived.
He said he was famished and wolfed his down, refusing to speak until he'd finished. Reed wandered over to the wall. Despite the late hour and the heat of the day, he was as immaculately dressed as always. Poe, who'd removed his jacket and rolled up his sleeves hours ago, managed a sly sniff of his own armpits. He'd need a shower soon.
"You heard Hillary Swift's in the clear?"
"She's involved, though," said Poe.
"No doubt," Reed said. "You think she was working for someone, or someone was working for her?"
Poe shrugged.
"She didn't recognize me. If she is working with the Immolation Man, then she's his apprentice."
Reed didn't have an answer. There was no answer. Swift was involved. They just didn't know how. Until she was caught, it would stay that way.
"What did you get from the social worker?"
Reed asked, ready to move on.
"I assume you think the boys are dead."
"That what you think?" Poe replied.
"Hard to see it any other way. I take it by visiting Children's Services again you're looking at the families."
"We are. But so far there's no one jumping up and down shouting, 'Pick me.' You've never read about a bigger bunch of wankers in your life. They didn't give a shit about the boys when they were alive. I don't see them developing consciences now."
"So we're back to an unknown. Someone who hasn't revealed their hand yet." He sat down.
"Speaking of Hillary Swift, Gambles asked me to tell you all that there's no evidence she's managed to leave the country. No one using her name or fitting her description has passed through a UKBA control point. Gambles convinced, and I agree, that she's holed up somewhere."
Poe grunted. Reed stood up.
"Well, it looks like you're all on a mission, so I'm going to love you and leave you. I'll call tomorrow if there's an update."
"Call regardless, Killian," Poe said. "We can tell you what we found."
He nodded and left. Bradshaw walked to the board. Poe joined her. She said,
"How about we use a third color, Poe? Vehicles we've ruled out that we want to reconsider."
Poe picked up a blue pen and said,
"Let's get started then."
They worked through the night, taking turns to nap on a sofa the porter had brought in. By 9 in the morning, they'd used 4 more colors and had stared at the photographs until it felt like their eyes were bleeding.
"This isn't working," Poe snapped.
He turned to Bradshaw.
"Tilly, can you please put that big brain of yours to use? Find me something I can recognize, because at the minute I can't see shit."
Bradshaw flinched. He apologized. It certainly wasn't her fault.
"That's okay, Poe," Bradshaw said. "You and D.I. Stephanie Flynn go to breakfast. I'll try an old university trick. If you can't see the pattern, change your perspective."
She didn't explain what she meant or wait for permission, just walked up to the wall and started unpinning pictures. Poe had seen her like this before and knew there was no point talking to her. She wouldn't be listening.
"Come on, boss. I'll buy you a bacon sandwich."
When they returned, the pictures were back up, but in 4 different blocks. There was a mixture of red crosses and green ticks. Poe looked at Bradshaw quizzically. The printer was clinking as it cooled. Bradshaw had printed off more photographs.
"We added more vehicles, Tilly?" Poe asked.
It would be a backward step if they had.
"I haven't, Poe. I've rearranged the photographs so they're now displayed on the day the victims were murdered. Each block is a separate day. I only had 1 photograph per vehicle, so if they appeared on more than 1 day, I had to print another copy."
She had obviously hammered more of Eskass's printing budget, because some of the vehicles were on all 4 days. Bradshaw had put the date and the victim's name beside each block. Poe ran his eyes over how the information was now being presented to them. Bradshaw said,
"While you look, Poe, I'll go and get a boiled egg."
She glanced at her watch.
"Rats, breakfast finished at 10. I just missed it."
"Only on Wednesdays and Sundays, Tilly. They need to set up for the Carvery lunch on those days. It's open until 11 today. You go and get your boil—"
The rest of the sentence died on his lips.
"What is it, Poe?" Bradshaw asked.
He ignored her and marched up to the block of the second victim. Joe Lowell had been immolated in the middle of the Swinside Stone Circle near Broughton in Furness. Telling Bradshaw about the hotel's breakfast had jolted something in the recesses of his mind. He could almost reach it. Almost, but not quite. Poe stared at the vehicles until they were burned into his retina. For 20 minutes he looked without seeing anything. 5 times he studied the block of vehicles, and on the 6th he saw the photograph that changed everything. There it was. Bold as brass. The anomaly. The vehicle that had no right to be there. Poe felt the hairs on his neck stand up.
Surely it couldn't be so simple.
Poe?
Flynn asked. For several moments he didn't dare open his mouth, and when he did, he ignored her question. Instead, he said to Bradshaw, Tilly, can you get me onto the HNCTS website and see which Cumbrian Court sat on the day Joel Lowell was murdered? Check Preston Crown Court as well. She glanced between Poe and Flynn, unsure what to do. Flynn said, Do as he asks, Tilly. They waited while Bradshaw logged into Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunals Service website. The information Poe wanted was publicly available, and he could have found it himself, but Bradshaw was quicker. Flynn had known him long enough to know she wouldn't get anything out of him until he was ready, so she didn't bother trying. 5 minutes later, Tilly said,
No court sat on the day Joe Lowell was murdered, Poe. It was a Sunday.
Poe nodded. He was right. He jabbed his fingers against the vehicle in Joe Lowell's block before turning to face Bradshaw and Flynn.
So what the fuck is that GU prisoner escort van doing there?
Chapter 48. Like most cops, Poe held strong views on the prisoner escort service and the shameful low it took in 2004 when it was taken out of the hands of the prison service and sold to huge multinational companies. For some time, those companies had been looking upon the annual 1.5 million prisoner transportations with their insatiable lust for profit. The fact that it was a Labour government that did this was no surprise to him. They were as susceptible as anyone else to those false promises of the private sector. Efficiencies and innovations. Innovations that included cramming prisoners into cells measuring no more than 2 feet squared, and efficiencies that included refusing to stop for toilet breaks, with the result that prisoners, some of whom were on remand and hadn't been convicted of any offence, had to piss and shit in their cells. Legally, animals being taken to slaughter were entitled to better conditions. By the time the Home Office realised what was happening, it was too late. Palms had been greased, directorships had been promised, and contracts had been signed. So they did what every government does. They lied and manipulated statistics. Poe knew there were no votes in telling the truth. As an extra kick in the public's teeth, and as an example of the law of unintended consequences, no one in the Home Office had considered what would happen when the first tranche of contracts ended and new providers took over. In a remarkable lack of foresight, no one had thought to regulate what happened to the vehicles owned by the original contractor when they were no longer needed. Entire fleets were offered for sale on the open market, and although the Daily Mail article highlighted the potential for abuse, the government was powerless to stop it. While the minister in charge blamed his civil servants, and the civil servants blamed their minister, the result was that for a few £1,000s, anyone could legally purchase a vehicle that was, in all but name, a mobile prison. The prisoner escort van that Bradshaw had placed on the Sunday block of vehicles was one of the smaller models. It contained 4 cells. Poe knew that some of the larger ones could transport 3 times that number. The smaller size meant it was nippy enough to get to all the locations to which the immolation man had been. None of the photographs had the driver in shot. The windscreen seemed to have been treated with some sort of tinting agent. Poe was unsurprised. There was some immediate work to do. Flynn called Gamble to tell him what they'd uncovered, and Bradshaw checked PNC. She found the registration number was still with GU Security. A call to their operations centre was met with an unsurprising eagerness to cooperate. Image is everything with the private companies who compete for public sector contracts. Yes, that was one of their 4-cell vans. No, it had never been in Cumbria, and no, it had never been involved in any part of the Northwest's prisoner escort contract. Vehicle number 236, as they called it, was used for a UK border agency contract in the southeast. And, yes, they could prove it. All their vehicles were fitted with satellite tracking equipment, so the control room knew where they were at all times. After GU promised to email the information, Poe ended the call.